101.9 FM for the best in local public affairs programming in Orange County. And if you're behind a computer, listen online at www.kuci.org. KUCI, commercial-free programming since 1969.
This is Michael Drake, Chancellor at the University of California, Irvine. And whenever I get the urge to hear the voice of independent music, I tune in to KUCI at 88.9 FM in Irvine or over the web at kuci.org.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this May 18th, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm Marie Stone and this is Writers on Writing. We are here each and every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. with authors, poets, agents, chatting about books and craft and writing process and marketing and publishing. We are giving you the scoop on the art and business of writing. We're focusing on fiction this morning, historical fiction and the short story. First up is the great Geraldine Brooks, and Laura Furman will be here in the second half hour with her latest short story collection, so stay tuned for that. Geraldine Brooks is the author of three previous novels, the Pulitzer Prize-winning March and the international bestsellers People of the Book and Year of Wonders. She was on the show a few years ago with me talking about People of the Book as well as her years as a foreign correspondent. She's also written the acclaimed nonfiction works Nine Parts of Desire and Foreign Correspondence. Her latest achievement is Caleb's Crossing, which came out earlier this month. It's published by Viking, and it's the drive behind some of our discussion this morning. Geraldine, welcome back.
It's wonderful to be back with you.
Oh, thanks so much. I want to start by giving you a chance to introduce Caleb's Crossing and talk a little bit about your inspiration for this one.
Yeah, I had moved to live full-time on Martha's Vineyard, which is a place that I'd been visiting for many years. And I was intrigued by the Wampanoag community that has lived on the island for millennia, and I wanted to learn more about them, so I gathered up some materials that the tribe had prepared. And one of them was a map that showed sites of significance to the tribe on the island, and on it was a notation that said, birthplace of Caleb Chechatia Mark, first Native American graduate of Harvard. And I thought, oh, how cool, I wonder if I'll run into him at the farmer's market. because I was thinking 1965 and the civil rights movement and all that. And it turned out that Caleb had actually graduated in 1665. Mm. And that date blew my mind because having grown up in Australia, not the U.S., I had no idea that Harvard existed in 1665, and much less that it would be a place where a young Native American raised in his own language and culture would find himself sitting down to study with the sons of the colonial Puritan elite in Latin mm-hmm. as well. So that became the germ of the idea for the novel.
You know, because I've been a fan of yours for a long time, and historical fiction is often a departure for me, I've been interested in following the kind of narrative strand of your own mind, and coming off journalism to the Black Plague, to the Civil War, to the Sarajevo Haggadah, to this book. As you reflect back over the body of fiction so far, aside from it all being historical fiction, can you kind of discern your own threads of interest? Are there kind of patterns in your thinking that you think have recurred over the course of the four books?
Absolutely. I think I'm in a monstrous rut, actually. A lot of people say, oh, your books are all so different. But actually, they don't seem that way to me, because I think that the remarkable stories from the past that draw me always have, in essence, a kind of central preoccupation with what happens to people in times of catastrophe or times of great change and stress, who is drawn to become their best self and who their worst self. And because any story in that's more than a century or two removed from our own time is very much enmeshed in the questions of faith, because religion was such an overwhelming force in the lives of people in the past. So there's always a look at what does religion do for you and what does it do to you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other thing that strikes me in looking across the four books
there are several things that strike me, but one is this theme of bridging cultures and people and ideas and the gaps that exist between us for all kinds of reasons and kind of the ways we traverse them. But this book kind of seems like the most explicit about reinforcing that theme. Do you think of that as a recurring interest, or am I off base here?
Yeah, you know, I really do believe my central belief, and I think what makes it possible for me to attempt to imagine my way into lives that are so different from my own and removed so far in space and time and maybe race and gender, is the central belief that what unites us as human beings is always greater, is always the greater force than what divides us.
Mm-hmm.
And every time we, as a species, have recognized that and formed societies that cross bonds and accept otherness, we make our greatest strides in science and in art and in civilization. And then when the recurring virus of our species rises up again and goes virulent, that need we seem to have over and over again to demonize otherness, then we tear ourselves apart and we break our beautiful societies, and it takes years to claw our way back out of the mess that we create. And I think we've seen that over and over through human history.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Geraldine Brooks. The book is Caleb's Crossing. Let's talk a little bit about voice, because your ability to adapt your voice is so striking. You know, I feel like there are a lot of writers that if you've read kind of the body of their work, you can pick it up and know that it's them behind it. And the thing that strikes me about you is that your characters sort of speak through you instead of you speaking through your characters. And I want to talk a little bit about how you do that.
It's the linchpin of every novel that I've written, I think. I can't actually start writing until I can hear somebody talking in my head. And try explaining that to an 8-year-old boy. My sons are convinced I'm a schizophrenic weirdo who communes with the dead. And in a way, I suppose that I am, because when I find these stories from the past where there's an intriguing skeleton of facts, but you can't know everything because the historical record is incomplete. That's the first step, but the essential condition for going further is to find somebody from that story who'll talk to me. And I go about it by reading everything I can lay my hands on that is written first person from that time and place, and sometimes that's not easy, and it wasn't easy with this book. I was determined to have a female narrator, and I was astonished to learn that there are no female diaries before 1700 in colonial America. So I couldn't sort of delve into journals or diaries from that time. And I found that where I had to go to find women speaking in their own voices was court.
Hmm.
Or confessions in church that had been taken down verbatim as records when women were being hauled into account for behavior that was considered unfitting for a Puritan goodwife, like scolding. That means speaking out against a man, usually your husband, but not necessarily. And it was considered inappropriate for women to publicly chastise men. And so you hear women defending themselves, and you get a good sense of their voice in those kind of court records. But Puritan women weren't encouraged to learn to write, and that also surprised me. There's quite a reasonably high literacy rate among the women of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, because it was thought good for women to be able to read their Bibles. But a wife wasn't supposed to write, because that implied that she'd be interacting with the world outside of her home. And that wasn't her business. That was her husband's business.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm interested in this kind of people talking to you from the past and how you bring this world alive. Some writers talk about really becoming friends with these people and how they kind of pull them into their daily life and live with these people in kind of a really real sort of imagined way. Historical fiction strikes me as a little bit harder to do that with, but tell me a little bit about how this impacts you at the times you're not physically writing and kind of how you live with these ghosts and keep this world alive.
Yeah, you know, I would find it pretty hard to be friends with some of my characters because they would think that I was a godless atheist, abandoned soul. So, because religion is so overwhelming in their lives. But the voices in my head are very distinct. And what I find happens is I find myself using these wonderful words from the past that nobody else knows any longer what they mean, and particularly the terms of abuse. I mean, you can, if somebody cuts you off in traffic, you can yell, "You tool!" but it's nowhere near as satisfying as yelling, "A pox on you, you rake-shamed fanfaroon!"
Oh, I love it. I'm curious about your desire to write from the female point of view, and if it's more of a reluctance to write from the male point of view because it's other, or because there's something about it that's not as intriguing to you, or tell me kind of about your draw towards women.
I think women's stories are more interesting to me, usually speaking. I mean, I did write most of March with a male narrator because to explore the themes that I wanted to get out of what happens to an idealist who goes to war believing in the rightness of his cause and then does things that are morally not right according to his conscience. To do that, I really needed a male narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And it was okay. You know, I was able to, certainly when you're writing in a male voice, you don't have to scrounge around for material. I mean, these guys, I was looking at Victorian idealists, and they banged on interminably in journals and letters, and it was very, very easy to read enough of their own writings to start hearing a voice for my character in my head. But I am more interested in the marginalized people and the people who have a bigger struggle in their social setting, and that in the past, generally speaking, is the women. So I'm interested in the voices that we don't hear in the historical record, and I think of myself as, you know, a filler of voids imaginatively, so I'd rather imagine what we don't have than what we do.
Who gave you the most difficulty in this book, character-wise, and kind of how did you wrap your mind around their psychology if they did give you problems?
Well, I didn't really approach it that way because it's all told by my young narrator, who's the daughter of the minister. So it's her view of these people, not mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so we as the reader know them only insofar as she knows them, and we understand them only insofar as she does. And she maybe isn't entirely in touch with her own feelings. There are times when she's probably an unreliable narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And we, the reader, probably have a greater sense of what's actually going on at an emotional level than she does.
Right, right. Yeah, it's so interesting. What was the hardest part of this project for you?
I would say trying to follow the line of fact as far as it led. And one thing that's exciting is I think that we're right at a point where narrative historians are reclaiming this particular history of early Harvard and the Indian College. It had been a neglected subject at Harvard for hundreds of years. They had turned their back on the early history, very inclusive early history of the college, which it's where the founding documents, the charter, is you know, quite explicit that the college is being established to educate the English and Indian youth of this place, and yet, as we know, for centuries Harvard became one of the most exclusionary institutions in America, where only one kind of person could ever hope to partake of its educational richness. And now, luckily, you know, there's been a turn back to inclusion of the surrounding community, aggressive recruitment of a diversity of students and making it financially possible. So there's an embrace of this history now, and I'm hoping that more voids in the record will be filled, because we've only got this one document from Caleb's own hand that tells us anything about his thought processes, and that was a letter that he wrote in Latin to the English benefactors who'd funded his education. And it discusses the myth of Orpheus as it pertains to his own experience of crossing between cultures and seeking culture. And, you know, I'm harboring this, you know, desire that historians will find much more about him and about his fellow Wampanoag student, Joel Iacunas, now that Harvard is turning its attention back to this period. So the lack, I think, of historical fact meant that the voids were even more extensive than usual for me. And in a way, it gives you more freedom, but in a way, I like to follow the line of fact as far as I can. And this line of fact was very, very faint and almost illegible.
Mm-hmm. This actually is probably a good time to talk about some of the recent events that are going on at Harvard with respect to some of the characters in your book. I don't know how much this book, which came first, sort of chicken or egg here, but how much this book influenced what's going on at Harvard now. But maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the neat things that are happening there with respect to this.
It's amazing the way it came together. I started thinking about this novel before I knew any of this was afoot, but when I started researching the novel, it was just before they broke ground on an archaeological dig in Harvard Yard that was designed to locate the Indian College and see what the archaeology might reveal, because Harvard had so lost this period in its history, they didn't even know where the Indian College had stood in the 17th century. So for 4 years they've been digging, and at the ending of the last digging season, they located the actual foundations. So now when the dig reopens in fall, they'll be able to go straight at it and straight down to the 17th century level. And I'm really hoping that we'll find out a lot more from what they can manage to turn up there. And also, the year after I started this novel, another young Wampanoag Indian from Martha's Vineyard became a freshman at Harvard College, and in 2 weeks from now, she will graduate, and she will be the first graduate since Caleb to complete her BA at Harvard College, which is a wonderful closing of that circle. And Harvard has decided, I'm delighted to know that they just decided that they will, at the same commencement ceremony, give a posthumous degree to Joel Iacunas, who completed the BA studies with Caleb, but was tragically killed before the commencement ceremony. So Caleb had to walk alone with his English classmates without his great friend and support. And so now Joel will be getting his belated recognition.
I love it. My guest this morning is Geraldine Brooks. The book is Caleb's Crossing. Let's talk a little bit about setting and the intimacy and importance of place for you. I know you live on Martha's Vineyard. Does living in these places help you, even if the events took place hundreds of years ago, to sort of, you know, live and breathe the vegetation, or does it not so much matter to you?
I think on the vineyard it's exceptional, because the island is only one-third developed. And although it's been quite changed in terms of what's growing there and everything since the 17th century, because 150 years ago the island would have been largely cleared for sheep farming, and then that passed and regrowth forest has reclaimed those cleared lands. So the trees aren't the same trees that Caleb and Bathia would have walked among, but it's close enough. And also, you know, the Wampanoag on the island have been remarkable environmental stewards of their own land. And so the traditions are very real and vivid. And every fall, there's actually, my kids are in school on the vineyard, and there's an excused absence for Wampanoag tribe members' kids for Cranberry Day, where they go and celebrate the cranberry harvest, as Caleb would have with his people all those years earlier. So there's a sense of the past sort of bleeding through the landscape all the time, and certainly, you know, the way the weather affects the surf and the way the mists roll in and out, that is certainly exactly as would have been experienced by the people of my novel, and I found that very helpful.
Mm. And likewise, you've been pulled to the 1600s a couple of times in a couple of your several of your books. Is there something about that time period? It seems like, you know, each book had its own sort of organic origin, but
I love that time period because it's the time when you really can feel the struggle of the modern mind to emerge from the medieval mind. So it's the moment when people's sensibility starts to get more recognizably modern, and you kind of, you can get their jokes, and you can, you know, so it's, and interesting stuff is in conflict in the 17th century. You've got the beginnings of science, the discovery of how the blood circulates in the body, the discovery of calculus, but you've also got women being holed up and accused of witchcraft. So it's you know, it can still go either way there. The superstition is very vivid, but science is starting to claw its way into people's thinking, and I really like that, the feel of that.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Geraldine Brooks. The book is Caleb's Crossing. Let's talk a little bit about structure. And I don't know if it gets easier over the course of four books. Is it getting easier to sit down and write a new one?
You know, I hardly know how to answer that. Each one of them is, you know, is so different. And to tell you the truth, I think having been a journalist for a decade and a half before I turned to fiction is very helpful in this. It's not that writing is easy or hard, it's just the thing that you do every day. Yeah. So get your bum in the seat and get on with it, kind of thing. And, you know, I know that's a kind of ridiculous position to take on it, but I do believe that I've benefited from all those, you know, editors who just, you know, I'd be sitting there agonizing over how to finish a news story, and one of them memorably came up behind me and said, "Where's the story?" I said, "I can't figure out how to end it." He said, end it, I'll end it." And he leaned over my shoulder and hit ENDS and pulled the paper out of the then typewriter, which is what we were using in those days. So, you know, you can, I'm a great believer in, you know, get it done no matter how crappy it is, because it's always easier to see the crappiness than to stare at a blank page of paper. And if you go wrong, then you can maybe get some clues about how you might change things and go right.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the structure of this. And it's kind of mostly told linearly, but obviously there's a couple of flashbacks here and there. Do you just kind of get it down, writing from beginning to end, and then go back and massage it? Or do you have sort of a point A to point B where you know you need to get? And tell me a little bit about structuring these.
Yeah, I'm kind of very instinctive because I never set out to be a novelist. It wasn't in the ambit, you know, wildest dreams of my imagination. I never did an MFA or any writing classes at all, really, except for journalism. So I don't really have a great sort of theoretical thing going on there. And once I've got the voice, I just let her tell me who she is, and who she is tells me how she's going to act, and that kind of sets the plot in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was a bit of a wish fulfillment there, because finding that there were no 17th century diaries, I thought, wouldn't it be great if somebody, you know, found one under a floorboard or something? And that kind of put the seed in my mind that this would be an intermittent record of this girl's life at times when she felt compelled to clarify her thoughts by writing them down, which is something that I've done over time, and particularly when I was an adolescent, you know. At times when things were confusing to me, I would write scraps of a journal. It was never a daily thing, but it was just at times when I was under stress. So what we've got here are three times in her life where she feels compelled to write down her thoughts.
There are a lot of writers who talk about kind of, I don't know what words to put to this, but sort of weird mystical experiences that happen to them during the course of writing it that kind of tell them this is the right project to be doing, keep going. Weird coincidences that come up either in research or in doing the writing itself. Have you experienced any of those that sort of tell you, you know, if you're off the right track to keep going?
Yeah, I had a whopper doing this book, actually. You know, when you come to somebody else's country, it's much easier to rummage around in their closets than perhaps in your own. I think I would have been really quite stifled taking on a story like this about a relationship between an Aboriginal Australian and a white settler, because there's just so much noise in my head of guilt and regret and all those things. And so, you know, Peter Carey talks about his feeling, which I don't quite buy into, but he feels like he's on a moral holiday in America, and that the problems of this society are not the ones that he has to take on his own shoulders. So I started off, I guess, in that blithe spirit. And as I was researching the book, I discovered, weirdly, that one of my several great-grandfathers almost certainly knew Caleb, because he was the brother-in-law of the schoolmaster who prepared Caleb in Latin and Greek to matriculate to Harvard. And he lived in Cambridge at the time when Caleb was at school with Elijah Corlett. And he was a glazier. He fixed windows. And so I've written him into the book as a guy who's called in after the Harvard kids have gone on a bit of a tear and broken windows. And so that's my great-great-great several grandfather there. And suddenly I wasn't on moral holiday anymore. Suddenly my family was part of this great dispossession, and the whole violent story of what happened between the English and the Wampanoag, and it's part of me now. So, yeah, you could say that was a coincidence.
Yes, you could. That's amazing. I want to give you a chance to read to us, actually, because I'd love to hear your voice in this story. Can you read to us?
Yeah, this is when Bathia and Caleb, I should say that these two meet each other as kids. She's the daughter of the minister in this rather marginal, struggling English settlement on the island, and he's the son of a Songkhem or tribal leader in a particular area, and they have a secret friendship, and they encounter each other when she's ranging around the island, supposedly gathering clams for dinner and really actually just sneaking out so she can study her brother's Latin books, because she's denied the education that her brother is being given. And these two, Caleb and Bathia, they have nothing in common in terms of their worldview, their life experience, their beliefs about how you treat the land, but they have one thing that brings them together, and this is their desire to learn and their willingness to acquire knowledge, whatever the risks they have to take to do it and whatever the costs. So she has sneaked out as usual, and on this particular day, I had made off with a new tract of my father's, New England's Prospect, by one William Wood, who had traveled on the mainland in 1633 and described for English readers what he had found there. I held it out, and Caleb took it. This was the first book he had held in his hands. He made me smile, opening it upside down and back to front, but he touched the pages with the utmost care, as if gentling some fragile-boned wild thing. The godliest among us did not touch the Bible with such reverence as he showed to that small book. He ran a brown finger across a line of type. "These snowshoe tracks," he said, "they speak to you?" I smiled. I could see how, to his unschooled eyes, the page might resemble snowy fields hatched by the crisscross of snowshoe sinews when the low winter sun lights up their edges. I said that they did, and pointed out to him the word for deer, at which he scoffed and said it looked nothing like a deer, but more like a snail. That in turn made me laugh, for he was right, and I could see that snail, its pronged head raised in the letter D, its shoulder curved in the double E that followed it. I explained to him that the letters were a kind of code, like the patterns worked into the wampum belts the Songkhems wore, that told some kind of abbreviated history of his tribe. But unlike the belts, which were rare and each unique, there were many hundreds of copies of this book, each just the same. "Manitou," he exclaimed, using his word for something godlike. So those coatmen across the sea, they can know of the plants and animals here, so many months' journeys from them? Yes, I said, exactly so. And men might know each other's minds, who had never met one another. Even those who lived many, many years ago may leave behind their learning for us. I told him how we knew of great cities such as Rome and Athens, how we read of their warriors and the wars they had fought, and how their wise men had argued with each other about how to live a goodly life. And now, I said, though their cities have fallen into ruins and the warriors are dust, yet they live for us still in their books.
Hmm. That was Geraldine Brooks reading from her book, Caleb's Crossing. We're drawing down on our time, but I want to leave with sort of a question about, you know, over the course of your years in journalism and your years writing fiction, and maybe over the course of or your experience being an expat working in the U.S., I'm wondering if there are questions we should be asking ourselves, both as writers or as readers, if there are kind of big questions and areas of concern, maybe that history repeating and history teaching us, or things that you've gleaned over the course of your career that are important issues that we should be thinking about as writers and readers.
Look, there are many important issues, but I think that we're missing the point here, because the most important issue of our time is the one that we are turning our face away from, and they make all the other issues pale into insignificance, which is the fact that we are burning down our only home and dancing in the light of the flames. I think if we do not come to grips with climate change and start making the really serious accommodations we have to make, every other issue about whether we're inclusive enough about one another or whether or not we should be involved in this war or that war just pale into insignificance. I mean, people worry about the effect on the economy. I used to walk past Wall Street on the way to work at the Wall Street Journal. We won't have an economy. Wall Street will be underwater. And I just think our inability to confront the seriousness of what's facing us is just, you know, I think people of the future will look back on us mystified, as we sometimes look at what the Puritans did. And they will say, what was up with them? They were flushing their toilets with drinking water.
Hmm. Yep. Very, yep, yep. Geraldine Brooks, this was a huge pleasure. I so appreciate you taking the time this morning.
It was wonderful talking to you.
Thanks so much. That was Geraldine Brooks. The book is Caleb's Crossing. You can visit her online at geraldinebrooks.com. There are great stories and interviews out about this book. It came out earlier this month, and I so recommend it to you. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. How'd you like that transition there? We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes, Talk News. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Laura Furman. Laura's the series editor for the annual Penn O'Henry Prize stories and the winner of the Fellowship of the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts for her fiction. She is the author of 7 books, including Tuxedo Park and Drinking with the Cook, as well as the memoir Ordinary Paradise. She's taught for many years at the Department of English at the University of Texas in Austin. Her latest collection of short stories is The Mother Who Stayed. It is published by Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, and it's the subject of much of our discussion this morning. Laura, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. I thought maybe we could start with a little bit in general with short stories themselves and kind of the work and the concern of the short story over the novel, which I think is, they're such different animals. In some ways, I think short stories are a little bit more akin to poetry than they are to novels. But I wanted to give you a chance to kind of talk about your philosophy behind the short story and what the concerns are with it as it differs from the novel.
Well, I think it's a question of intensity. Not that novels are not intense, but that to me is the hallmark of the short story. That to echo Clark Blaise, who wrote a fabulous essay on the short story years ago, the beginning of a short story is the cracking of an egg or the first note of a symphony breaking silence. And the short story has a particular form and a particular relationship among its parts that that ends with really two endings, with an ending to the plot and then an ending to the secret or the heart of the story. And at least I haven't been able to figure out to say in that same concise way what a novel does. I think a novel does many different things, because a novel can be a very slim, wonderful novel like So Long, See You Tomorrow by William Maxwell, or it can be War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. So the novel can expand and shrink, but it always, to me, has a sense of taking up as much space as it wants, whereas the short story has kind of particular duties and a kind of, as I said, intensity, and carries those out. And I don't know if that's very vague. I think people want a definition of the short story, and actually it's quite a varied form. And one of the things I like about it and enjoy about the reading I do and the writing I do is that even given the confinement of this form, you can kind of punch those walls and see how much more you can do within the form.
I like it put that way. Yeah, it does strike me as short stories sort of leave you off kilter at the end, and things aren't wrapped up as neatly, I guess, as they are in novels. And you had talked about the misconception of the short story being that people are looking for meaning, and it sort of either intimidates them or leaves them, I don't know if it leaves them feeling unsatisfied or sort of at loose ends when you get to the end of a short story that doesn't often tie things up the way a novel does.
Yeah, I just was one of three judges on the Penn Faulkner annual competition, and I got to read more novels last winter than I've read in years, and one thing that really struck me was the amount of explaining most novelists do. And how in a short story, I think that generally, at least short stories that I love, don't explain much.
Mm-hmm.
You depend on the reader's intelligence, mm-hmm, and the reader's own sense of responsiveness to the world of the short story. Whereas it's perfectly honorable in a novel to have 10 pages of background for a character, mm-hmm, and then go on with the story. But the detail you have to choose in a short story to just say the right thing is very different, at least from most of the doorstopper novels I was reading.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that is one of the ways in which it's more similar to poetry than it is to the novel form. That not just the brevity, but also the assumption that the reader will read between the lines a little bit more than they do in a novel.
Oh, absolutely. And that has to do with trusting the reader.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you tell short story writers in this bleak market where short story writers are told, you know, you're never going to get your collection published and they're hard to sell? And because it feels to me, I'm a huge champion of the short story and I seek them out, but it feels to me like there's more collections out now than there were maybe 10 years ago. I hope it's enjoying a little bit of a renaissance, but I'm wondering if there's what you see the future of the short story as, and if you discourage people from, if you try and encourage them back into the novel where they might have a chance at publishing.
Well, I think actually the short story is doing just fine. Publishers have always been reluctant to publish individual short story collections. I mean, my first collection was published in, I think, 1978 or 77, and it was short stories and a novella called The Glass House, and it was seen as a prelude to my novel. That was the way the publisher was happy to publish the collection, but would have been happier if it had been a novel. So this has been going on for a very, very long time. I mean, as long ago as the career of Catherine Ann Porter, she was plagued and bullied into writing a huge novel called Ship of Fools. I mean, she procrastinated for 45 years to avoid finishing the thing. She was really a short story writer. But I think that now, particularly because of the proliferation of graduate programs, there are more short stories being written than ever.
Mm-hmm.
Students are trained, young writers are trained to write stories, and it's kind of happenstance in a way, because it's possible in the length of a semester to look at a couple of short stories by a writer, whereas if you're looking at pieces of a novel, you're always, a novel in progress, you're always kind of in the position of the person touching the elephant's trunk and saying, well, this is obviously a snake.
Mm-hmm.
So all you can really do, Don Bartholomew once said, you know, all you can really do with someone who's writing a novel is to be encouraging and say, well, that's good, carry on. Because you know, you don't know until it's over, and that could be years.
Right.
Whereas with the story, there are lots of stories being written. There are lots of magazines publishing the stories, both in print form and online. There are lots of contests. There's lots of everything. And I'm not sure if this is a renaissance or not, because I don't feel well enough versed in literary history to say that. But I think that there are lots of collections coming out from big publishers and little ones and university presses, and somebody's reading them.
Yeah. I am. The soul reader. you raised a point kind of in the middle of all of that about people who are essentially short story writers and versus, I'm wondering if you think there are kind of essentially short story writers versus essentially novelists. I know you've worked in both forms. Do you think people sort of settle into one or the other as their natural style, or do you feel pretty comfortable going back and forth?
I think a lot of people switch back and forth, and after spending so many years on The Mother Who Stayed, I've just started what I hope will be a short novel taking place in Paris about a group of friends in Paris when one falls ill, how they react.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of enjoying being able to just keep on going.
Right.
It's very different writing and I'm never sure if writers really choose what they want to write, or if it's dictated from internal forces that we don't really have much control over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, maybe I'm being too woo-woo about it, but that's how I always feel.
No. I mean, that's echoing what we hear a lot here, which is, you know, the subconscious does so much of the work for the writer, and you don't know what's going to come out, and it's I guess that's what makes it interesting, and not airport readish, and you know, pat, which is
exactly. And you know, I would love to write a big epic family epic, but I don't think that's the way I'm built, and I don't think also that's what I'm going to do. And so this Paris thing, I think, will be a short novel. I mean, it may end up being a short story.
Very neat. My guest this morning is Laura Furman. The book is The Mother Who Stayed. Let's talk about the book. Why don't you introduce the collection for us and tell us a little bit about the thinking behind it and the inspiration behind it?
Well, most short story collections are, you know, you organize them by pretending that the reader is going to read from front to back and trying to give the reader the best experience possible. What I did in writing and also in organizing this was to take the nine stories and divide them into three trios. So it's really three groupings of short stories. And there's also an overreaching theme of just a look at motherhood and obviously also a look at what it is to have a mother. And the first trio takes place in New York City and is in the 50s and 60s. The second one is centered around a writer I've invented named Marian Foster Todd. And it's about Marian and what she does to other people and what her life is like from her biographer, from a person she thinks is her daughter. And then the final one takes place in upstate New York in 1874 and also in the 1980s. And so the collection covers a lot of different times and places, but has an interest in motherhood, I think you could say that, in each story. And what I wanted was for the stories to stand alone, as I believe short stories have to. Mm-hmm. But I also wanted the reader going from story to make those connections and to say, but wait a minute, Marian didn't do that. You know, why is so-and-so saying she did? And to be able to, in essence, be putting together a larger work out of these three individual works. And it seems to happen that way from the response readers have given me.
Yeah, it's really satisfying, I think, to in linked collections in general, this is a really satisfying read to be able to kind of dart in and out of people's lives and people's times and in different points of view and see things from new angles and have, you know, backstories fleshed out all the while with these being their own self-contained gems. And I think all of these stories were published independently in different journals.
Yeah, they were. There's only one story that wasn't published, which is The Hospital Room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such a great structure. And I know that in the past you've compared this to kind of musical themes, the concerto structure and kind of recurring refrains. I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit and kind of how music and the other arts kind of play into your structure.
Well, I've always had a very strong visual sense. Don't know as much about music, but I love chamber music, and I love the way, you know, you listen and you pick up what the theme is, and then the theme changes and is varied, and the variations make the theme more complicated, and you think you hear an echo, but it's really something else, and then in the end you return to a resolution that's also its own individual piece. That's not just an echo, but that it's become something else. And that's very much what I wanted with these stories, was for each to be its own self, standing alone, but also to take strength and depth from the other pieces, which I think is what happens in music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love it. I love it. You've written about motherhood, I think, a lot over the course of your career. And I'm wondering, as we sort of hit on a little bit earlier in our talk about the subconscious doing a lot of the work for you, I'm wondering if there are things about your own subconscious that you feel like you can't escape in fiction, if certain things kind of, if your mind keeps traveling over similar terrain, and how much of the work is kind of your own volition versus how much of it is just sort of out of your control and done for you, and you're kind of there to massage it into the best story you can, but don't have as much control over the subject matter.
Well, I'm afraid I after this collection thought, okay, that's it for motherhood. That's it for mothers and daughters. And so the new thing I'm writing, I thought was going to be about friendship, but of course there are echoes of mother and daughter and sisters and all kinds of other things in every relationship between women.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And between, you know, with married couples. And in all relations, we kind of echo our familial relations. And for me, I mean, it's partly personal history. My mother died when I was 12 and a half, and so that loss has been the echo for me in everything I've written. Mm. But I would like to start writing also about the gains and about women's friendship and what we can do for each other and what we do for each other, and the ways in which we make each other's lives better and possible to live.
Yeah, nice.
And also the ways in which we fail each other because we're human and can't help it.
And women.
And women, yeah. Right. But at least we'll always talk about it a lot.
Right. Let's talk about voice for just a moment, and taking on these people from different perspectives. You obviously write in first and third, and I'm wondering if all of these are kind of little pieces of yourself that you bring up to the surface, little pockets of you, or if you kind of step into another persona and really kind of divorce, when you're doing your character work, really kind of divorce yourself from, I don't know how you actually do that, but really try and take on a different persona and see things from a different point of view. As you're mining through your characters, tell me a little bit about that process, how much of it comes from inside and how much of it you kind of consciously try and step into somebody else's body and head.
A good example to look at would be the biographer in the story Here It Was November, who narrates a story about her research into the life of Marion Todd.
Mm-hmm.
and kind of gets a confusion between herself and Marion, and also speaks in a very kind of academese, even though she's an independent scholar, she speaks like an academic. And having taught for 28 years, I just retired from UT, I certainly spent enough time listening to academics so that I didn't realize it, but I could mimic that voice pretty easily. But that character really developed over a number of years as I wrote the story, and I realized that there was part of her that was me and was my experience of, for years, teaching seminars in biography writing and helping people learn how to do research, and that maybe that was my classroom voice, even though I pretended I didn't have one. So I think that all the characters are at least partly myself, but they're very much themselves also. And after I've kind of written myself through, I can then give them more. I never had the experience that the child Dinah does in Plum Creek of being alone out in the country when there's a tornado coming.
Yeah.
But I've lived in the country a lot and alone and had my faithful dog with me. And so I was able to kind of extrapolate and become this child Dinah from that.
Right, right. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time, but I also wanted to at least close on your experience with the Pen O. Henry Awards and looking at a kind of a body of short stories over the last several years, and what sort of makes a successful short story in your mind.
Well, I think the most important thing is the creation of a whole world, so that whether the story is a tiny story or a very, very long story, that the reader is taken to another place, and the reader can escape from his or her own life into that that other world. And I think that's what gets me about all the stories that I choose, and they're all very different, but I have to be taken by them. I have to be absorbed.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Laura Furman, this was an enormous pleasure this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That was great. That was Laura Furman. The book is The Mother Who Stayed. It's published by Free Press, out and available now. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
There comes a time.